You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com.
Yes, it's Thursday night. My name's Russ McKenzie. We are not so much live, but we're back with Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. I am joined by Matt Pollard tonight. How are you doing, Matt?
Here comes Club America. Oh, God, what do we do?
Well, it's not often we have not one but two midweek matches to talk about tonight. So, three actually. Matt just alluded to, Club America absolutely laying a beating on Herediano. It wasn't even like Herediano had it up on aggregate. And it felt like midway through that first half, Club America already had it erased.
I mean, it was basically Germany-Brazil in the World Cup semifinal.
It's interesting you mentioned that because I tweeted something out like that last night, and that was quite popular actually. The Game of Thrones pushing in the, you know.
Oh, the mountain and the
guy whose head got the red viper. squished like a grape.
Yeah, Prince Oberyn.
That R.I.P. basically, that the soccer equivalent happened again last night. Like,
yes,
it wasn't close. It wasn't ever close. And
only one of those goals came after the red card for Herediano, if I'm not mistaken. So you're talking four goals in 30 minutes at 11 men aside, and just immediately you were figuring, we'll come in, we'll bunker, we got a 3-0 lead, it'll be fine, and then immediately it's gone.
Not in Mexico City anyway. Not only that, we have an MLS club that has reached the final of the CONCACAF Champions League. Most unexpectedly, the Montreal Impact have put on a good enough performance to wind their way through the minefield that can be CONCACAF. They weren't seated high, so they did play. They played tough clubs all the way through, and now they meet their toughest opponent in the hulking behemoth that is Club America of Liga MX, and I just don't see it. I don't see it going well. if Herediano had the ability to bunker in and keep Club America at bay, Montreal would have had a chance to beat Herediano. The problem is Montreal is now facing Club America, and I don't see that going well at all. It's not an even matchup at all.
With Justin Mapp and Cameron Porter and playing playing in front of 65,000 Montreal fans in the second leg, I'd give them a chance. But I think they're going to run out of gas, to be honest. Russ, I think they were holding on for dear life in stoppage time yesterday. I don't know that I see it happening, to be honest.
Well, they open up down in Mexico City, so who knows what's going to actually go on there.
Yeah, a 2-0 deficit going into the home leg might be insurmountable. You know, they need to keep Club America from scoring more than two goals, and if they can nick even just one on the road, that'd be huge for them.
Yeah, no, for real though, if they can come out of there with like a 2-1 or 3-1 loss, and then tie it somewhere along the way, on aggregate, they might have a chance. But I just don't see it happening. I don't, which is a shame because it's been a hell of a run for the Impact, and you know, with some of the questions that they have on their roster, for them to be able to do what they're doing is an accomplishment in itself. That's not to say, you know, they should be happy and rest on their laurels for getting this far. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. I think that they need to push as hard as they humanly can and maybe make it respectable, because it can get sideways on them very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So let's dive right back into MLS action. We'll talk a little bit about North American Soccer League later in the show. I actually had a chance to sit down with New York Cosmos manager Giovanni Savarese, Venezuelan national, former Metro Star, and current head coach of the New York Cosmos. But that's in the second segment. Right now, we're going to jump into some MLS action. Let's talk about the game that happened last night, the match between Vancouver and Columbus. And, you know, it's very interesting to listen to the podcast circuit, right? The internet radio circuit of, like, Soccer Morning and Extra Time Radio and all of that. And, you know, one thing rang clear after week four, both Jason Davis and Andrew Wiebe agreed that the level of play was not great in week four. But it seems that, I mean, if, you know, we went over a little bit of it in the review show on Monday night, but if any match proved that the level of play is there, it was Vancouver Columbus. Did you have a chance to watch any of that?
I did have a chance to watch it.
You know, let's take out the fact that Vancouver plays just incredibly beautiful soccer. I mean, it really is something to behold with Kakuta Mane and you know,
Pedro Morales, Octavio Ribeiro, yeah, Darren Maddox.
Like, you can go down there, roster, and these guys know how to play. They know how to they know how to be dangerous on the field at all times, and it's a passing, it's a pass fest. They pass and they pass and they pass and they pass and they pass, and they test the waters, and they poke and prod the other team until they find a hole to get through. And they do it in such a way that it's so fast. So for Columbus to come out of that with their injuries and missing Frederico Higuain, you know, to come out of there with a 2-2 draw last night, that's got to be something that they can rest their laurels on. And you know, really, Vancouver's not the easiest place to play. That is a hostile crowd there, and it was a packed house on a Wednesday night, which is fantastic to see in MLS.
Mm-hmm.
But just beautiful soccer from Vancouver, and they just keep getting better. You know, again, there's been some talk about, is Vancouver for real? There was all this chatter about last season about them being great, but needing to make that next step. And really, having Octavio Rivero has given them the bite that I think that they were missing.
Absolutely, Russ. We see all the time, you know, an MLS team that, you know, is sound defensively. Obviously, I think there's a good young core forming in Vancouver. I think Carl Robinson's done an excellent job. You know, obviously they have Kakuta Mane. We've mentioned Darren Maddox, who has been off and on, but then, you know, they've got Gershon Kofi, you know, they've got, you know, Osed, who I think is having, you know, probably his best month to 6 week period, other than that rather sloppy second goal to Columbus that he gave up, you know, so far in his time since joining MLS. So they've got a good young core. Then obviously Pedro Morales is your DP number 10, but they didn't really have a regular striker. You know, all of them are relatively young, so it's a bit problematic. And then they bring in Octavio Rivero. He's going to score chances if you give it to him. They've gotten him chances. He's scored goals. He's leading the Golden Boot. They're top of the table.
Yeah. So let's move on. We both can agree that Vancouver is the place to be. let's talk about a team that, you know, a lot of people are calling the best in MLS. playing arguably one of the worst teams in MLS on Friday night on Unimas and MLS Live. FC Dallas versus Colorado Rapids. Colorado has yet to score a goal this year. And, you know, there's been some rumblings that Pablo Mastroianni is coming to the end of his tenure in Colorado almost before it really began. Do you see Colorado scoring? Do you see the drought ending?
I think the game against they're in Dallas this weekend, and I think that could be a real trap game. Obviously, Dallas didn't have a great game against Portland last week. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, but I think I see them scoring one way or another tonight somehow, or excuse me, this weekend. And I don't think – I mean, to that point, though, Russ, I don't see how is the current team right now a fault of Pablo Mastroianni? He comes in, you know, gets appointed head coach, I want to say the day before the first game, you know, even though he'd been mulled around as part of being part of the coaching staff. No idea who was making moves. It was essentially, you know, a complete stagnancy with the roster. So he inherits, yes, a young team that obviously Oscar Pareja was able to do good stuff with, but Oscar Pareja is a much more experienced coach. This is Pablo inheriting a young roster with not a lot of veterans, not a lot of reliable, experienced MLS players, and then he's a coach who's learning on the job as well. And then on top of that, halfway through the season, they lose their two center backs, including their captain, Drew Moore, and arguably their two most veteran players that they have on the roster. So I can't fault him for the way last season went. And then, you know, what, 3 weeks into the game, they sell Deshaun Brown, who was their highest goal scorer the past 2 years, and they don't have Edson Buttle. And, you know, Gabby Sanchez has been probably one of the biggest non-Chicago Fire DP duds in MLS history. Okay, excuse me, non-Chicago Fire, non-Toronto FC duds in MLS history. So, I mean, you really want to – and then, okay, yes, I can validate the decision to sell Deshaun Brown knowing that Doyle is coming in the offseason, but he's not getting here until June. It's April 9th. Yeah. So who's scoring the goals between June 9th and – between April 9th, excuse me, and June, July, whenever it is Doyle gets here, gets fit, and is able to start with the team.
Exactly.
So, I mean
it's tough.
I won't go as far to say that, you know, oh, if Bruce Arena or Siggy Schmidt had this roster, they would be doing much better. But I can't see how any of this – you know, this is circumstantial and this is timing and very much situational. I can't see how Pablo's on the hot streak, considering the fact that he was literally Colorado's only option and he was born and bled in the organization. So I don't see how you can do that to one of your own.
Well, it's interesting. We're actually in the process of getting someone from the front office of Colorado Rapids on next week. I won't tell you who, but the process of elimination. You know, I think Colorado is in a very interesting situation. I think I don't think that the calls for Mastroianni's head are really anything short of nonsense, to be fair. And, you know, I think that's – I just don't – I see Colorado waiting it out. Patrick Smith just waiting it out until the end of the season to make a decision, seeing how the period from June 9th until, you know, October goes to be a real test. I think that they have a good chance of scoring on Friday night, but I do see FC Dallas just.
I don't see Colorado getting their first win of the season.
I don't see it either. Maybe a draw. And maybe a draw at best. You're going into Toyota Stadium. It's a hostile environment.
Yes.
So let's talk about other coaching things going on. You know, on Saturday you got New England Columbus, but really it's this Philadelphia Union New York City NYCFC match that really is the kicker for me. Rice and Bowley basically has been told to take his ball, sit in his apartment, and wait for a call. He's Jim Curtin came out.
Contemplate life.
Yeah, just contemplate. Just think about what he's done. Sit in the corner and think about what he's done. Jim Curtin has basically benched him for the foreseeable future.
It's a home bench. Like, this is borderline. This is soccer house arrest, yes, for all intent and purpose.
But you looked at that match that they played last week, and you saw his body language. It wasn't good in that match against Sporting KC, and you know he hasn't been active. You know, when he played in the World Cup, you saw him be active and directing his back line and always being the key, being the guy who organized the team in defensive third of the field. You didn't see that in Philly. You haven't seen that. I don't think you didn't see it last season when he played. You nope. certainly didn't see haven't seen it this season. So
nope.
I think Jim Curtin is perfectly within his right to go say, "Hey, go sit at home, think about your life, and let us know when you figured it out." I totally support that decision. But can it get any worse for Philly? You know, Jim Curtin finally gets rid of the interim tag, and then he gets this guy in. I can't pronounce the name. The striker that they signed. Let's call him Mr. Striker for now because I can't pronounce the name.
Agüesta? Aristigueta.
There it is. Aristigueta. Thank you.
It's almost as hard as Alajuelense.
Alajuelense. I love that word, by the way. Anyway, moving right along. So they get, say the name again.
Aristigueta.
Thank you. They get him, and he's a good striker. I mean, he's a dangerous player. But they can't seem to get the ball up the field, which leads me to believe that they need to move Maurice Adu up into a holding mid spot and shore up their center back situation, because they, you know, you spend a little money on center backs and it's wonderful, but you put your DP center back in that really should be playing holding mid. Dax McCarty's don't grow on trees.
Nope.
So, you know, you got to get him pushed up so he can get the ball to the attack, and I think that's the missing link in Philly. I think it's that link between the defense and the offense.
Because, I agree,
because they have the attack. Sebastian Latou is no joke. Sorry, keeps cutting you off.
It's okay. Well, I would almost say I would switch. I don't know if they've been running a 4-2-3-1, Russ, but I'd put Adu in the two as the box to box and have Brandon Carroll as the stay at home guy to cover the back line. And then from there, I think you have something. I guess my question in all this was, you know, okay, so can we agree that I'd say throughout the entire of 2014, the only two players I can't blame on them not making the playoffs last year were Sebastian Latou and Zach McMath. Yes?
I totally agree with you.
I would put an asterisk on Maurice Adu because of him coming in late, having to readjust to MLS, and obviously focusing on trying to make the World Cup squad and not making the World Cup squad. I don't know how much his psyche was affected by that. But those are the two players you can't really blame. Latou is one man. He can only do so much. He cannot be the entire offense for this team. And basically, the only time in which he's not getting swallowed up defensively is when he's taking set pieces and it's required by the referee that nobody be within 10 yards of him. So, you know, other than that, and then, you know, okay, Rice and Bouley, you know, they're sending him home. Andre Blake, their first-round draft pick from 2 years ago, he's coming back from injury. Why was Zach McMath loaned to Colorado when they already have Clint Irwin, and Clint Irwin's played every single minute for them this year? Now, Clint Irwin hasn't been great. It certainly hasn't been his fault of the way Colorado's been. But, you know, they've been pretty sound defensively for the most part, all things considering the fact that they don't have an offense either. So Zach McMath is sitting on the bench. You know, why did they think that Mboli was going to be be the answer? Okay, that's conceivable. Why aren't they on the phone right now with Colorado trying to get Zach McMath back? Who could at least in some way, he could at least stabilize the back line that would at least somewhat negate the removal of Marisa Dew from the back line.
Because that's Philly. That's Philly. I know that's a maddening answer, but think about this. Think about that for a minute.
Hashtag poop.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go there, but thank you. So let's move on. DC United versus New York Red Bulls. Now, Alec Rivera, who is usually on the show with us tonight, messaged us before the show, before we started recording. And apparently, Steve Goff broke that Eddie Johnson will likely be retiring due to a heart condition. I hate to talk about that during an Atlanta Cup bit, but, you know, he's so young and it's such a shame. But you got to do what's best for you. But he's got to do what's best for him. And if that means not playing, then that means not playing. Unfortunately, you know, things happen. But we hope you get better real soon.
Mm-hmm.
That said, New York Red Bulls are without Roy Miller and Ronald Zubar again, which 3 weeks ago would have scared the crap out of Red Bull supporters, but now you're looking at a back line that seems to be pretty solid Kamar Lawrence and Anthony Wallace there filling in for Roy Miller and Ryan Miller. Hockey playoffs. Oh, man. So Roy filling in for Roy Miller and the young Matt Miazga filling in for Mr. Ronald Zubar. You know, Zubar also has had a history of injuries, too. And it seems to be this hamstring injury keeps popping up, which may be why New York Red Bulls got him in the first place so easily. I think it's going to be a great match. I think, RFK is always a fun place for the Red Bulls to play. I think that, you have DC, who is quite possibly the luckiest club in MLS right now.
I tweeted last week, Russ, after they beat Orlando, that DC has gone San Jose Goonies on MLS.
Oh, I think so. I totally think so. You know, and it's funny, everyone looks at that scoreline when they were at Red Bull Arena, and everyone says that that Red Bull stomped DC, and that wasn't the case at all. DC actually put up a pretty good fight in the second half. First half was totally not them. Red Bulls ran rampant over them. But in Red Bull Arena, that second half, the danger was real more than once. And, that scoreline would have been a heck of a lot closer if, Pontius's ball had not sailed into orbit. A penalty kick there. Mm-hmm. So let's jump... let's jump to Sunday here. We got, we're skipping around a little bit. Orlando, Portland, and LA Galaxy, Seattle. Matt, give us a little bit of this. Give us a little bit of preview of this LA Seattle match.
Oh,
you know I was going to ask. You knew I was going to ask.
That doesn't mean I have to be, that doesn't mean I'm ready for it, even if I've been prepared. Okay, let's see here. As exemplified in the game at DC and the game at Vancouver, the current Gerard-less iteration of the Los Angeles Galaxy is incapable of maintaining possession, playing tiki-taka up the middle, and doing anything. The two offensive plans right now are spray it out to the wings where one of our outside players delivers in a cross that's way too high and easy for tall center backs to gobble up. Not that Robbie Keane is particularly good with his forehead as far as scoring goals. At least that's not his forte. Zardes is capable in the air, but not when he's outnumbered 3-1 between two center backs that are as tall as him, and then obviously a keeper who's able to use their hands. And then the only other option when we are remotely able to play tiki-taka was basically when a team on the road, i.e. the home game against Houston and Chicago, were sitting back, in which case the offensive plan is everybody pass to Robbie Keane and stand around and wait for him to do something.
Sounds like
obviously Seattle is probably not going to sit back for 90 minutes and concede possession to allow a high volume of Robbie Keane trying to pull something out of his you-know-what or waiting for Ishizaki for one of his one-in-one-million crosses to actually make it onto the forehead of a Los Angeles Galaxy player. I think we're – I'm not ready to – I know too much – I've seen this team do it far too often where – they have a terrible start to the game. They figure things out. They make a Bruce Arena makes a few GM moves. Then they start revving it up in July. And then by late August, first week of September, they've hit third gear. And then they're off. They're in a playoff spot. They're right back into competing for the Shield. And everybody is terrified of them. And they're destroying teams left and right. So I'm not ready to hit the panic button on that yet, but I have a feeling that it's going to be waiting and seeing, like, can we just hold on until Stevie G gets here and can that transition be smooth? And if that transition is smooth, I don't know what happens to this team. If it is smooth, then I think we're going to be okay in the long run. In terms of this game on Sunday, though, I feel like this is both teams needing to make a big statement game. Obviously, Seattle, I think, in a way, not necessarily conquered the Galaxy last year, but I think they conquered their bedwetting fear of them in the fact that they just sort of – they completely collapse in the biggest moments, usually against the LA Galaxy, usually in the playoffs against the LA Galaxy. And I felt like they took a step forward in what they did in the Supporters Shield showdown in the last two regular season games of last year. So I don't know that that's necessarily – that that's going to be a huge problem for them. But I do think that they see this as a statement game, and obviously with the Galaxy reeling in the way that they have been the past two games, I feel like this is a statement game, and I don't know what to make out of it because I'm not sure where the health of the Sounders are going to be. Obviously, their big guns were able to play, but I don't know how much of that was, oh, we're playing at home against Houston as opposed to on the road against L.A. Supposedly, Ozzie Alonso could be available. We'll see what state he's in, and I think the Galaxy, it's just all – let's just calm down mentally and try to be more sound defensively and be able to better handle pressure and try and create something offensively. So I think that's going to be intriguing, but I mean, I don't see the Galaxy winning this game. We can do picks later if you want, Russ.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I don't see LA Galaxy winning this game either. But I think it's more about Seattle trying to exercise the demons of their past. Always had problems with the LA Galaxy. They always do. You know, it's been that way for years. And I think that this year, for Siggy, it almost feels like it's the last piece of the pie for him. He needs to get an MLS Cup with Seattle, with the tools that he has, because he has a fantastic roster. Really one of the best. And I think that I just think that's going to be the way to do it. I think that part of it's going to be beating LA in LA. That said, I think you're right about LA. I think their midfield is a mess. I think that it almost feels like they're in a holding pattern until Stevie Gerrard gets here. But and again, I keep asking this question, and time will tell whether I get a straight answer or not. But how much damage can the LA Galaxy do to their season before Stevie Gerrard gets here? And will they be able to come back? Because you're not talking about having him ready until July. So you have July, August, September, October, 4 months.
It's going to be okay in that context, Russ. Six teams from the Western Conference are making the playoffs. I think the Galaxy can be better than four of the other nine teams. I do not think that that is going to be a concern. Now, obviously, wanting to avoid a wild card game, that could be a little bit problematic in that sense, but I think, you know, I'm going to keep saying it until either Gerrard gets here or Varianen or Husidic or whoever can prove that they can fit into the center midfield role next to Juninho, I think this is what we lost in trading away Marcelo Sarvis. Like, that's – it's the what we lost in trading away Marcelo Sarvis show in that sense. And, I mean, you know, some people have said, oh, clearly it's Donovan when we've gotten good – I think for all things considered, I would classify Jose Villarreal's play at left midfield to be pleasantly impressive so far. But you lose Sarvis, you lose Donovan – That tandem combined for 45% of the Galaxy's chance creation last year. And I think whoever they've put in at central midfield next to Juninho hasn't produced. I think Villarreal has done better than expected, but he hasn't been what Landon Donovan was in 2014. And Gerrard's going to have to come in and be a borderline best 11 player if the Galaxy can't at least start doing something better in any one of the phases that I've alluded to.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you there, and I think that, and again, I do think LA Galaxy makes the playoffs. I have them making the playoffs, but that it's going to be in that sixth seed. That said, we're going to jump to break right here. You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. When we come back, we're going to hear from. New York Cosmos head coach Gio Savarese, and we're going to have a nice giveaway from our friends at Brooklyn Bound Soccer Club. Only here, Last Word on Last Word Soccer Club. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Welcome back to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name is Russ McKenzie, joined once again by Matt Pollard here. You're listening to the sweet sounds of the Cuban Jazz Combo, which I figured was a perfect lead-in for our next guest here. Matt, I had a great opportunity this week to sit down and have a chat with former Metro Stars legend and New York Cosmos head coach Giovanni Savarese.
No way! Awesome.
Yeah, Venezuelan national, great guy. We got to talking about upcoming trip that Cosmos have planned to go to travel to Cuba and become the first professional soccer team to play professional sports American. Let's see if I get this right. First American professional sports club to play there in a whole lot of years, and the first soccer club to play there in 54 years. It's actually pretty impressive by them. And of course, you know, it's Cosmos, so they have to make the headline. But we got to talking about Raul, and it was a great conversation. While we're about it, and speaking of New York soccer, Brooklyn Bound Soccer Club, we kind of have a relationship with them. I'm close with Roger Turley, who helps run that club. They're an amateur club. They are playing in the Cosmopolitan League in New York City. They are hosting tryouts to get onto that to join the club. And in a minute, I'll have a date for you. That said, we are giving away a party pack courtesy of Brooklyn Bound Soccer Club. By the way, the fall 2015 tryouts take place 4/19 and 4/26, 1 to 3 p.m. in Red Hook. Register today, bbsc.nyc/tryouts01. We're giving away a party pack in honor of their inaugural season in the Cosmopolitan League. It's two pint glasses and a T-shirt, courtesy of Brooklyn Bound Soccer Club. Matt, we're going to ask a question here, and I don't want you to blurt out the answer. Okay, so you got to hold on to yourself.
Okay.
It's So the Cosmos are the first American professional sports club to play in Cuba in many, many years. My question, and the first correct answer on Twitter or email, you can email us at lastwordsc@gmail.com. You can tweet any one of us, but the home Twitter is at lastwordsc. The my personal Twitter is at Russ_McKenzie, and Matt Pollard is at LWOS Matt Pollard. You can hit us up at any time on Twitter with this answer. So the deal is, who was the last American professional sports franchise before the Cosmos to play in Cuba?
Ooh, and David Beckham's MLS team.
Yeah, not really. And what year was it? And what club was it? Those are the two answers. By the way, quick update. I've reached out to the director of communications for New York Red Bull, asking about an update for Peggy Lou Yandula, who has been rumored to be on the fence about whether he's going to retire or not. And the news is that there is no news. He has not decided yet. Come on, Peggy. We're all sitting here waiting on bated breath. Make a decision. That said, let's get into this conversation with Coach Savarese. You're listening to Last Word on Sports, Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name's Russ McKenzie. I am very, very proud to have the pleasure of speaking with former Metro Star legend and current New York Cosmos manager Giovanni Savarese. How are you tonight, Gio?
Very good. All good. Very happy to be on your show.
We're very happy to have you. So tell me a little bit about let's talk about this your first match with in the spring season here with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. It seemed like you guys came out and had a little bit of trouble handling them in the first half, but it seemed that you built momentum as the game went on, especially starting noticeably in the in stoppage time in the first half and leading on to the second half. Why don't you tell me a little bit about some adjustments that maybe you made some adjustments in the locker room before the second half. Take me through that game a little bit.
Yes, first of all, I think we expected the game to be that way. The Strikers have some interesting players. They have a new ownership. They had a great night with 11,000 fans coming in. They had just a few guests. They have a good coach, so we expected that the first few minutes they were going to come and throw everything at us, try to pressure us, try to win space with speed, and I think we did a good job to maintain our goal in Euro. They definitely created some interesting opportunities at the beginning of the first half. But then, as you mentioned, we were able to adjust. We were able to settle. We were able to, you know, keep the ball a little bit more and beat the lines of pressure in order for us to be able to find more space and attack. And we did a much better job the second half. Basically, I think based upon two things, I think our guys, fitness-wise, felt very good. The second thing is we pressure higher and we allow them to be able to make more mistakes closer to the goal, which allows us to play more on their half. So I think those were key things that allow us to be able to be better the second half. But I'm proud of the character and the personality of our players in the way they were able to handle the match and get a very good win away from them.
Tell me a little bit about, Raul came out a little bit earlier, probably than you had wanted him to, but tell me a little bit about that injury and how has there been progress and will he be in the game this weekend against Indy?
Yeah, it was a precautionary decision. He felt a little pull in his hamstring, more than a pull, just tightness. Just we wanted to make sure that we, you know, that we don't push him, that that he can be healthy for the entire season. And we felt that the smartest thing was to pull him out, get him some rest, get him ready. That way he can come back and not aggravate the situation, and it could be something worse. We're very pleased with the way he played. He's a smart player. He gave us a lot of interesting things during the match, which is what we expected. And now he will be, you know, ready for this weekend. He will be training fully tomorrow. So we will evaluate the situation, but we expect him to be ready to play this weekend.
Perfect. What kind of can you talk about the impact that Raul's had on the club, especially with the experience that he has? Do you see him filling a kind of leadership role that with the players, especially some of the younger guys? And what do you see? How much playing time are you realistically getting from him?
No, he's been tremendous for us this season. He's been tremendous for us to help the players grow around him, to make us a stronger team. His demand for quality is all around us, and we all need to be better in order to make sure that we bring our team to a higher standard. You know, and he's just used to a lot of quality, and he's been able to do that with us. And he's a good teacher to a lot of the youngsters. So with him, with Marco Senna, with the veteran players, we feel very content in the role that they play in the team.
That's fantastic. Now, also, Raul's expressed his desire for a future in coaching. Do you see him joining you on the sidelines in the future?
Definitely. I think he has the quality. He's, you know, when you're a small player in the field, you know, and you're always analyzing teams and things that happen inside the game. Those are the key factors, I think, to make you a good coach. And the passion to it is very important. And I think he has all those tools to end up being a coach in the future. We'll see what direction he's going to take and what he's going to be, you know, looking to do. But you know, if he decides to go the route, I see a very successful coach in the future.
Now let's talk about some youth movement here. It was announced recently that the Cosmos had signed U.S. youth international and LA Galaxy prospect Haji Wright. What is it that you see in the 17-year-old, and will he see regular matches in the NASL?
I think he's a talented player. I think Haji has a lot of qualities for 17 years old. He's able to, you know, do a lot of interesting things on the field because of the talent. But also, I think we need to work with him to further develop him, to build a little more character, to make sure that he learns how to use those tools that he has in a much better way. And for us, you know, I think he's a player that can give us some interesting things this season. We want to make sure that he's a better player in order to be able to help the national team, the U-17, when they go to the World Cup, that we can hopefully, you know, allow him to have the future that he can have with his talent. But when he will be used or where, you know, we don't know yet. It depends week to week. What I can tell you is that he's always a contender and you know, a player that is battling to get in the 18 and to be a starter, like everybody else on the team. And time will tell if he's going to be able to, you know, find his way into the roster. Better said, into the 18 or as a starting position.
Sure. So, and here's just a follow-up with that. Do you see this starting a theme of NASL clubs pursuing and signing MLS Academy products?
No, I think the NASL has the freedom to be able to do interesting things. And I think we prove with the signing of Haji that that we can sign a talented player, young, and be a part of his development and be very serious about helping him become hopefully the player that his talent pushes him to be. And, all the teams will be doing things. I think the league has grown. I think the teams are stronger. It's more, more interesting players coming into the league. And the team just as a whole, soccer is growing in general. In the United States, we see crowds in the NASL and MLS becoming bigger. And I think this is a positive response of this year. I think this year is been a very key year for soccer in the United States.
We happen to agree with that sentiment.
definitely.
So let's switch gears a little bit. Because the Cosmos are historically known for making headlines, and it seems that they've done so once again, this time traveling to Cuba and becoming the first American soccer club to play there in 16 years. Can you tell us a little bit about how that developed?
First of all, we have to remember that this is the 42nd country that the Cosmos will visit in the history of the club, which is quite amazing, and it shows exactly what you just said before. The history of the Cosmos is well known worldwide, and right now what we're doing as well, it is, capturing, the interest of the people that at the end of the day is traveling to these places to unite through soccer. Communities, people, and be able to bring a facility on the day that the national team is going to play us. This came along as an idea of a few people. And then in January, when Luke Sassano and myself traveled to Jamaica, we were able to sit down with the help of the NASL and CONCACAF with the representatives from Cuba, the Cuban Federation. And at that point, they were interested. And from that point on, every part associated with making this possible has been very helpful in order to make sure that this was a reality. So we're very excited to be able to be the team that is traveling back after so many years. That is a soccer team that is going to be traveling to make this interesting event. And everybody is excited about that. But right now we're thinking about next game, and that's our main focus. And when the time comes to travel, then the team will focus on that task.
Of course. So speaking of international subjects, and this is one of our one of the questions that has come from the Twitter world. Would you ever consider coaching the Venezuelan national team in the future?
Definitely. I mean, I have a passion for my country. I played, for La Vino Tinto for many years, and definitely it's in my heart. So I don't rule that possibility out in the future to be able to be part of that. The time will be right when it will come, the opportunity, hopefully. And it's definitely one of the things that I'll be proud to do in the future. But also at the same time, I wish Chita San Vicente the best of luck to keep on working, and hopefully he does a great job with our national team.
Sure. So a couple of questions coming back to just circling back around to more recent events. Have you heard any movement on the Cosmos Stadium bid for the land next to Belmont?
That's more of an office question. We all very optimistic still in the technical staff, the players that will see a stadium soon. But more of the details, can be, said by the front office. Who's, they are on a constant basis, looking after and trying to see when that possibility might happen. For us, will be very important. But everyone here remains very hopeful of that possibility.
That's great. I have been waving the flag for you guys to get a stadium for a while. So finally, one more question, Coach Savarese. What are your expectations for the Cosmos going into NASL spring season?
my expectation is to win this weekend.
Fair enough.
We wanted to win last week. We did, with the work of the players putting a lot of effort into it. And now the second task is to win Tumunda this weekend. We're not looking past this weekend. We are making sure that we take one game at a time, that we respect every team that we're playing against, and that we take every game very seriously. And then at the end, if we're able to accumulate enough points to be able to do something important, then we'll look back and assess the season. But at the moment, we're looking week to week, and for us, the final is this weekend against Indianapolis.
Coach Savarese, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you.
No, thank you. It has been a pleasure. Take care.
You too. Have a pleasant week.
You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Welcome back to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name is Russ McKenzie. I am joined once again by Matt Pollard, and this is the portion of the show that we really let our hair down and really just do a roundtable thing here. And one of the people that I really can't believe that we haven't had him on the show yet, John Bava, who's the beat writer for Columbus Crew for Last Word on Sports. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Last Word Soccer Club.
Thanks. Great to be on. First time here, and hope I do a decent job.
Yeah, no, it's fine. This is the one we don't have to worry about. This is where the random hashtags of, you know, space elephants. This is the segment that this kind of thing comes from. So we're just gonna jump right into it here. Oscar Pereira versus Caleb Porter and Tissue Gate.
Oh God!
So apparently, what went on was, and you hear a description of this from a couple of different people. My favorite description was Simon Borg's, telling of the tale, so to speak. You're watching the match. The two coaches go up to each other, and Caleb Porter's, just wandering up, sticking out his hand for a handshake, and Pareja holds something up to his face, and then tries to hand it to Caleb Porter, and Coach Porter says, "Nice, look at the scoreboard," and throws it back at Pareja's face. Ivis Galarsep of Soccer by Ives tweeted out a nice little vine of this that clearly showed Pereja handing Caleb Porter a tissue, and the lip reading experts looked at it and said, okay, that's what he's saying, and then Porter defiantly throws the tissue in Pareja's general direction and walks away. Spice coming out of Portland versus Dallas, man. You gotta love it. What do you think? Yep. What do you think, guys?
I absolutely love it, to be honest, Russ. Not to say that anyone's particularly a villain in this. I think that Pareja has a point in terms of, reading between the lines, coaches are crying to the refs a little bit too much. I think he handled that necessarily in poor taste, and I think the way that Porter handled it, not going to say that he's vindicated by it, but, I probably would have done the same thing, and obviously I think it was a disrespectful way that I think that Pareja expressed it himself, and I just, as soon as the next time Portland plays Dallas, anytime, I want a camera on both of these every 90 minutes. And I don't even want to see like the refs or any one of the players or anything. As soon as the whistle blows and it's full time, I want a camera on both of them together.
Yes, yeah,
I want to see what that interaction is like. I want some spice to it. I want some villainy. I want, we don't have, you know, we've got articles coming out about, oh, is RSL Seattle the new Great Western Conference rivalry? You know, I feel like this is something that is now a talking point that's bullet board material that could then develop into something else. You know, the same way we talk about how the joke I mention every single time the Galaxy play RSL is it's the grudge match of the grudge match of the grudge match of the grudge match. Yeah. This is the Montague and the Capulets, you know, the what's that TV show about, like, they're in the middle of West Virginia and the two families hate each other and nobody remembers why?
Hatfield and McCoys.
Yes, like this is the thing that starts Hatfield and McCoy that I want to see more of, that's a greater talking point in the league. So I love it. I want to see more of it, please.
What do you think, John?
Well, it's kind of interesting because it kind of reminds me of during the MLS All-Star game when the All-Stars played Bayern Munich, and they were quite physical, especially towards the end, and Bayern Munich's coach was Pep Guardiola. Yeah, he wasn't very happy about that, and obviously, you know, that was kind of a, you know, that was Caleb Porter too, so, you know, he's kind of gotten into it with two coaches already, and like you say, it'll be interesting to see what happens when these two teams meet again.
I'm with Matt. I want the assistants to wear GoPro chesties.
Oh my God!
And I want to see it. Like, I want to see it from that angle. But not only that, you know, it reminds me of some of the, okay, so 2013, 2014, there was no love lost between Mike Petke and Ben Olsen. I mean, totally no love lost. And they do not, they're fierce competitors, and we all know that they're rah-rah guys, right? So I remember in particular at the end of the 2013 season, Red Bulls pulled off a draw against DC. And it was one of these last minute things, and you could tell that, and literally Olsen and Petke got into a yelling match on the sidelines, and you know, you don't see that very much from soccer coaches. You see other things, them yelling at players or they do it through media, but this, I love this kind of spice. I just do. I love pouring on the cayenne pepper. I cook that way. I love spice. So my thing, Oscar Pereja versus Caleb Porter, I will absolutely watch the next two matches between Dallas and Portland, and I hope to hell they face off in the playoffs, because that would be epic.
That would be epic.
Anyway, moving right along. Next thing we're going to talk about a little bit. Well, let's go back to rivalries, John. John, you know, a lot of people talk about this, the rivalry between Toronto FC and Columbus. Mm-hmm. Is that a real thing, or is that more of something in Toronto's head?
Well, I mean, the league tries to kind of make it a real thing, you know, with the whole that, you know, the Trillium Cup, you know, there actually is a real Trillium Cup trophy that goes to the, you know, team that has the best record over the course of the season. And, I mean, it's, you know, for the Toronto game on March 14th, I mean, the Toronto supporters, they were in full force. I mean, I think they brought like 500 supporters down there. And, I think in time, I think, you know, over the next few years, especially if Toronto can finally, you know, put things together and make a playoff run and not be so, you know, dysfunctional and everything like that. And, you know, I think if both teams are in playoff contention late in the year, I think that has the chance to blossom into, you know, a pretty good rivalry. I mean, I don't know if it'll rival, you know, like DC United Red Bulls or, you know, the, Houston FC Dallas, which, you know, that's kind of regional, everything like that. But, you know, who knows? I mean, I think it could be pretty good.
Well, I mean, the other thing with that is, you know, I think Columbus is in an interesting position. My favorite moment, really, of the last couple of years, and I talk about it all the time, is this when Atlanta was announced as the next MLS club. The picture of General Sherman.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that right before I came on, because that actually, I'm sure you all are familiar with Keith Olbermann, and you know, he's on ESPN. 2 now, and he has like a show, and he does a similar thing to what he did when he was on MSNBC.
The
like
worst the whole person in sports.
Yeah. And Columbus supporters group, Massive City, actually made his list. And actually, I think they were number one. And he was talking about how, you know, they sent this, I think it was a tweet to the Atlanta supporters group when MLS announced Atlanta as one of the new clubs. And it had, you know, the picture of Sherman and the implication there. Sherman was the Union general that burned Atlanta to the ground. So, you know, that's why I guess they ended up on Olbermann's list that day. That
high quality troll job by Columbus supporters.
That was interesting.
And the perfect way to start a rivalry.
Yep.
Going to the next topic here, let's talk about this leaked 2016 U.S. Men's National Team Copa Centenario jersey. Matt, your descriptions are usually best. So, and you're the one who took issue with this. I really, you know, don't have a feeling on it either way. I think it kind of looks cool. But, Matt, why don't you walk us through this jersey?
Okay, so you can Google this pretty easily. You do U.S. Men's National Team Copa Centenario leaked jersey. It's one of the first things that comes up. It's basically, if you search leaked U.S. soccer jersey, it's the first one that comes up that's not the new blue jerseys, basically. And so it's blue from about the shoulder to, I'd say, about where Clint Dempsey's nipples are going to be up. And then from down there, say, maybe 6 to 8 inches or so until you get to about the bottom of your side ribs, it's red and white stripes going vertically, sort of like the tassels of a scarf or the tassels of the stripes of the flag.
So
and then
slimming
it's all
stripes,
white from
Matt.
The bottom. Yes.
They're
and then
slimming
it's all,
stripes.
Yes, yeah, slimming stripes. And then it's all white from the bottom. There appears to be a jock tag on it, similar to what Adidas has done with a few of the Jersey Week jerseys the past couple weeks and the past couple years in MLS. It's a little bit hard to make out from any of the images if it says anything, and if so, what on the jock tag. I don't know, maybe One Nation, One Team, I Believe That We Will Win, who knows. That would be awesome. I'm recommending
that.
That
would
actually
be cool. I would kind of like them to kind of, you know, kind of incorporate the whole I Believe That We Will Run right onto, you know, at some part of the jersey.
Yes. Okay. So in any case, that's the league jersey. I think it's a little bit hideous, to be honest. I don't mind them necessarily changing the jerseys, but I guess Russ and I were talking a little bit off air before we started recording, and my big point was if I had one wish that I could implement for the U.S. national team as far as kit, apparel, merchandising, what have you, that would then stand the rest of my lifetime, it would be, let's go back to the centennial crest. And on a philosophical level, I would want, if I had a second wish, it would be to piggybacking off of that, I would want the kits that we have that are for important events, mainly World Cups, but I guess we could extend it now to our first Copa Centenario. Is the jerseys that I like the most are the denim jerseys from the 1994 World Cup,
yeah.
And then also the red and white horizontal stripes that we kind of wore in, I think, the 2010 to 2013 time period in between the World Cups. And I like the two of them the most because I feel like I'm wrapped in the American flag. Mm-hmm. So to any future U.S. national team jersey that's for any significant event that wants to have sentimental value with me, make it such that it feels like I'm wearing the American flag or something of that ilk.
John, you go first.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that, you know, last, you know, during the last World Cup that I just was, you know, the road jerseys was like that shade of blue just doesn't really, you know, that's not really American flag. I mean, it's more of like a navy blue, and that was, you know, that was kind of a qualm I had with those. I mean, it was a cool design, and you know, I kind of agree with you. It just seems with this 2016, and actually I brought up there's an article on MLSsoccer.com where they have a picture of the jersey, and then they have a picture of Captain America right next to it. You know, because Captain America kind of has those kind of those vertical stripes, you know, mm-hmm. on top of like the blue and everything. And maybe,
fine, do the Captain America suit. I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they could just try to make it look almost exactly like it. But
replace the crest with the Captain America shield.
I'm there. I'm with that. I like that one.
When Clint Dempsey throws his mighty shield.
Oh,
actually, one of my favorite designs, anyone that kind of has the diagonal stripe, and I know, I think the 100, the, you know, the the Centennial ones. I think they kind of had sort of like a shade of it. And I remember, I think for a while they brought back the 1950 World Cup jersey, you know, to kind of, you know, throw it back to when the U.S. upset England. And, you know, that was around for a while. And I was kind of ticked off that I wasn't able to buy that because, it, you know, they went out really quickly. And then I tried looking on eBay. I couldn't find it. And I mean, that was a jersey that I was really hoping to own, but, I don't know, for some reason, I love the diagonal stripe. That's one of my favorite aspects of, you know, the U.S. jersey.
Well, Matt mentioned the horizontal red stripes. I'm sorry, Matt. I've got to disagree with you. The thing looks like Where's Waldo, and I said that every single time I saw it. And I said, when is Waldo coming out to play soccer? And it irritated me.
I respect that. Okay, but do you like the sentiment of make it feel like the jersey is made out of the American flag?
I love the sentiment. And the fact of the matter is, it's unfortunate that the Bomb Pop jerseys didn't take off because it really grew on me. The more I saw them, the more I liked them. Covering U.S. women. They were wearing them a lot, so I really like that jersey. Except the fact that nothing good has happened in either case that those jerseys have shown up in play. Nothing good has happened. We drew against Mexico, and then we lost Jose Altidore in the World Cup, and that kit was never seen again. as far as I know, we haven't worn it since the World U.S. Men's National Team hasn't worn that since the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
So. I think that's pretty much the way of it there. Interesting piece of information here. Just throwing it out here, headlines here. We had Coach Owen Coyle from the Houston Dynamo on a few weeks ago, and we'd asked him about Kubo Torres, and it says he's going to watch Kubo in the Mexico friendly versus the U.S. To gauge where he's at, and he still won't join Dynamo until July, which has got to hurt the Dynamo real bad at this point. It's not good.
I mean, anytime Giles Barnes is your lone striker up top who's going to be scoring goals, it's not conducive to making the playoffs in the Western Conference.
Yeah, seriously.
He actually had the lone goal against Columbus in that first game. You know, I mean, Columbus just completely dominated in terms of just, like, shots. And, you know, it was I think it was kind of an against the run of play goal. And, you know, the crew back line just was kind of sleeping and he just buried it upper 90. And that was that.
Is that Houston's only goal of the season?
I'm not quite sure. I mean,
look that up.
Hold, please. This is why we need a dedicated producer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hang on a second. So while I'm looking this up, so Eddie Johnson's retirement looks like it's actually most more than likely he is going to retire from playing soccer at this point. And you know, here's a question for you guys. And what kind of legacy does Eddie Johnson leave behind? We talk a lot about during the off season. We talked a lot about, you know, the legacy of players like Thierry Henry and Landon Donovan. Well, Eddie Johnson was a name in the U.S. men's national team, and U.S. men's national team play for a long time.
Yes.
So what kind of legacy does Eddie Johnson leave behind if all of this is true and he does actually retire, which by all reports he's going to, and if it's a heart problem, he definitely should.
Oh yeah, very much so.
Mm-hmm. From what he did on the field, I think you're going to see a controversy. I almost want to equate him, I guess, to Allen Iverson in a way, in terms of, not necessarily in terms of his physical style of play, because Eddie's very much built to be big enough to play his natural position, but just in terms of constantly having a chip on his shoulder, constantly being, you know, stirring the pot, antagonizing his opponents and feeling the need to prove himself. And then in the moments where he does achieve that, you know, that's almost, it's a good redemption story for him in terms of what he was able to accomplish, you know, every single time he was sort of on the outs with the club, and then he found a rebirth and he did a little bit of that for Seattle, and then it didn't work out money-wise, and then he came in with DC and it just didn't really work out. But I mean, from the time that he started, you know, the MLS Insider on him, you know, it was about redemption and about working for, you know, grinding his way out of what was growing up in an impoverished setting and fighting for that and fighting for his two little daughters. And I think he had his heart on his sleeve in that sense, and I think that's to be commended. I think from a bigger picture off the field, I think it's a what could have been, you know. I mean, you know, barely missing out on the 2014 World Cup roster. Did he miss out in 2010 as well? I think so. After he made it in 2006 and then he wasn't with the team in 2010, right?
I'm reasonably sure that that's the case.
Okay, so I mean, you know, it was kind of a, you know, 2014 was, I guess, supposed to be him getting back into the swing of it. And now it's kind of, we're never going to see where that narrative comes of, you know, could he have been involved in the Gold Cup, potentially made it in 2018, or at the very least been a reliable striker for DC United and when he was needed with the U.S. national team. So I think that's a question. That's going to be the, you know, the final paragraph, I think, in his Wikipedia page and his player playing career section, unfortunately.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it says, you know, he was named to the pre-roster for 2010, but, you know, he didn't make the main roster. But, I mean, you know, he's had a pretty good career. I mean, you know, he did a little bit of stuff in Europe, came back to MLS. He was, you know, he was pretty good for the Sounders. You know, I think he had 23 goals for them, you know, in with his stint with the Sounders. And, you know, like you say, you know, could have worked out a little bit better with DC. And, 63 appearances for the U.S. national team, you know, and it's been pretty good. I mean, I just remember, wasn't there on Twitter last year? I mean, there was like this kind of, I forget what was going on. I don't know if it was like, he was just constantly tweeting about like something that was like bothering him, and I don't remember what that was.
Well, I remember. I remember at the beginning.
Get into an incident with a DC fan at one point. Was that what you're referring to?
I think so. Bava,
yeah, and then I think as a pseudo ice bucket challenge, Clint Dempsey challenged Eddie Johnson to stay off Instagram and Twitter for a week.
I think he made it. But you know, it's interesting, and I wish Alec was here because he'd be able to talk about it a little bit more. Yeah. I've often wondered where Eddie Johnson was going, and you know, he never really was that offensive force with DC United. He never was that target striker that they always wanted and needed him to be. Mm-hmm. However, and he just had zero chemistry with Fabian Espíndola. Luis Silva was definitely the better choice there, and it really is frustrating as a fan of the U.S. men's national team and as somebody who also watched that special on Eddie Johnson where he talked about redemption and fighting for every single inch of success he has had. It's just a shame that he's not going to be – he may not be playing anymore. I kind of liken it to Eric Lindros. Eric Lindros changed the game of hockey. Mm-hmm. He changed the game, and he'll never get full credit for that because his time was cut short, and he kept trying to get back and never quite did it. Eddie Johnson will never see how far he could have gone. We'll never see it, and he's so young, and that's really what the kicker is. Eddie Johnson's hold up play was a lot better. He slotted into more of a playmaking role than a goal scoring role for DC, especially in CONCACAF Champions League. He was one of the cogs there that kept them going, and he had a great showing through there. That was really the last of it. And it's just such a shame. What's his legacy? Well, I'm not sure that can be adequately written because we never saw him consistently do he never consistently reached the potential of what he could do. You know what I mean? And it was, and it's tough to watch at this point. By the way, I looked it up. Houston Dynamo has scored not one but two goals, one at home and one on the road. So they have a nice pair going there. So let's see what else we got going on. Let's talk about let's cap it off the way we started and talk about CONCACAF Champions League, John. Did you see the match against Alajuelense?
Montreal?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, it was crazy. I mean, you know, late in that game, you know, the fans kind of started, you know, despairing. And, it, you know, the I mean, it, the stadium kind of just turned into a powder keg. I mean, they were throwing stuff out on the field. I think Evan Bush, I think, got hit in the back of the head with a coin at some point. And on a kind of really negative note, Dominic Aduro tweeted out after the game that he was, you know, and this goes back to the issue in Europe with, like, you know, racism at soccer games. And, you know, he tweeted out that, you know, fans making the whole monkey noise thing. And, you know, he was saying, you know, it was like, shame, you know, shame on these Alajuelense fans for doing that and everything. But,
And then I think immediately after the game, Dak said, "Congratulations, Montreal, now run to the airport."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was thinking the same thing. I'm thinking, you know, they're, you know, they were, you know, when they, you know, looked like they had taken a decisive lead. And I'm thinking, you know, once this game ends, man, just get off the field and just get out of there. But, you know, Alajuelense, you got to credit them. I mean, they made it close, and, you know, they ended up winning the game 4-2. And the only reason that Montreal's going through is, you know, the away goals. And, you know, they're going to have their hands full with Club America because, you know, if that game with if the game in Estadio Azteca with Herediano was any indication, you know, when you're in there with that altitude, and, you know, things can happen pretty fast, and it sure happened. I mean, it was like 5-0 after, like, I think a half hour.
Yeah. Now, okay, John, we talked about this a little bit before you came on. What result do you think Montreal – what's the worst result Montreal can get in the first leg to give themselves a chance in the second leg at home, and what was hopefully 65,000 Montrealites, Canadian people at the Olympic Stadium?
Well, I mean, just based on what happened in the semifinals, you know, I just if they can get an away goal, I think they're in good shape. I mean, if they 2-1 would be huge. I mean, if they could just maybe, you know, lose 2-1, that would be really nice, because, you know, then you got an away goal. All you need is a 1-0 win at home. I just don't think they want to go down any more than like a 3-goal deficit. I think then you're really asking for trouble. And, you know, there's obviously going to be a lot of pressure on them. Just, you know, number one, you know, an MLS club has never won the competition and, you know, made it to the Club World Cup. And you know, even more so, you know, a Canadian club similarly hasn't, you know, won the competition. But, you know, it's going to be fun to watch. And one of the things I was thinking about is with the Canadians in the playoffs around the same time, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what's a hotter ticket. If those, I mean, I'm not sure if, you know, they'll have those two games at the same time, but, you know, which will be a hotter ticket, the game at Olympic Stadium, if it's held there. I'm not sure if it's going to be held either at Stade Saputo or
it will be at Olympic Stadium. And I think the latest number I heard was this afternoon when they closed the ticket office, it was 35,000 tickets sold in what is about a 65,000 seat venue. And that game will occur on April 29th. So yeah. I've got to think that the lower bowl is at least going to be packed, if nothing else.
Which I think is a Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. So,
it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I say, you know, Montreal's obviously a huge hockey town. And when they're in the playoffs, you know, that city just revolves around the Habs. But I think there's a chance that the Impact could kind of upstage them a little bit.
I think the other thing there is that it has to do with the level of competition. Also, Montreal's ownership came out and said they're disappointed about the soccer culture in Montreal, that they're disappointed in the fan base. And I think that a lot of Impact supporters are taking that to heart now, and they're showing up. They're showing up for this club when it wins. Now, no one wants to see an MLS club, playing in MLS, and then end up second to last in the league. Thank goodness for the CCL run, and Montreal would have nothing to look forward to.
Yeah. Now, it was interesting, like when there was all the talk of the strike and the lack of a CBA, but that week before, Montreal was there in the CCL, and they got that huge goal from Cameron Porter, and the crowds were good then, and that was kind of, for a while it was kind of like, is this going to be like the only MLS we're going to see for a while if they don't hash out the CBA? Obviously that they got it all done and that didn't happen, but that was I think for me, I think there was kind of like an added level of excitement just to, on account of that, because I was kind of like a little bit of uncertainty with the MLS regular season, but yet you had these you had DC United for a while in the CCL, and
the other going back. Well, excuse me, guys. I'm sick. So if you hear me coughing up a lung, I apologize. So let's just circle back around here. You were talking about fan violence, and it's not very often that I get to report something good about this. I have been kind of following the situation as it develops in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a piece a couple weeks ago that no one was happy about. We had Kevin Mercer on, who writes for the mainland. And then, he actually sent me in the direction of the Citrus Bowl, who tweeted that they are now starting a text message violence alert program. So if you see it, you report it, and you text it to this number, and that automatically goes to Citrus Bowl security and the police. And, I tweeted at them. Well, I included them. I tagged them in a tweet and they about it. And then they, tweeted back at me, safety first and then teamwork. And that's really, I've got to say, bravo Citrus Bowl, bravo Orlando City for taking the initiative and fixing the problem before it became out of control again. And really, you got to give it again. You got to give them credit to that.
Yeah, they were proactive, and actually, that's something. The whole text message thing. I think you see that a lot in NFL stadiums nowadays. I just know because given I live in Buffalo and I've gone to Bills games every once in a while, and you see it on the scoreboard, like text. If you have an issue in the stadium or in the parking lot at tailgate, text your issue to this number, and then hopefully the security will take care of it. So I mean, it's good to see MLS clubs in the event that fans get alcohol takes over and fans just think want to cause a ruckus, that there's the club will step in,
especially when there's history of it there, and that's really what the important part of that was.
Yep.
Anyway, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been great.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Check us out on iTunes and on Stitcher and on Podbean and, of course, at lastwordonsports.com. On behalf of John Bava, Coach Gio Savarese, and Matt Pollard, we wish you good night and good luck. You've been listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com.